Bet365 sponsors the TIFO Football Podcast, and they feature over 300,000 sporting events on their betting app. It's got everything you need to bet on sport. Bet365 are offering a wide range of markets, including first, last, or anytime goal scorers, and with over 45 million members, is the world's favourite online betting company. With the Bet365 Bet Builder, you can combine match results, players to score, number of goals, and more to create your own personalised bet. And if you can't watch the games live, with Bet365's Match Live feature, you can now follow every moment through live graphics and text. Bet365 is the world's favourite online sport betting company. The app can be downloaded from the Google Play and Apple App Store. Over 18s only, please gamble responsibly.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine, and today I'm joined by Alex Stewart.
Good morning.
And Seb Stafford-Blore.
Hi, Joe.
Welcome one and all. Today, the three amigos, you and I, will be discussing broad themes, broad ideas that came off the basis of a few of the weekend's games. We're going to start by talking about Fulham and Arsenal. As part of that, we'll discuss Gabriel, of course, and Willian, and we might discuss the goalkeeping position too. But beyond that, in the podcast, we'll be discussing Liverpool, Leeds, very exciting, and Tottenham, Everton, which I'm most personally excited about because I very much enjoyed watching that game. But something that has no negatives is The Athletic. If you visit theathletic.com/TIFO, you will be able to download The Athletic app currently for an introductory offer of £1 a month, which is exceptionally cheap for something, well, for full access to an incredible app with all sorts of features. My favourite thing about it is that you don't have to compromise with The Athletic. If you are, an Everton supporter, for example, we're going to come to talk about Everton later, I'm pretty sure you're going to want to be reading the full-length features and the interviews and the analysis about your team this season, because everything's very exciting, isn't it? So for £1 a month, you can join the crew. That is theathletic.com/TIFO. I would highly encourage you to do that. And it makes me look good at my workplace, so please do it for me. Anyway, that's all. I will leave you in the cool hands and the warm embrace of Alex and Seb. Okay, let us begin, as we said we would, with Fulham Arsenal. Fulham nil, of course. 3 Arsenal, that's how it's written. I like to read the scores in that order. Let's begin at an obvious place, Seb. Gabriel, it was his first performance. Tell me, what did you think about him? I'm going to come to Alex also to ask what we learned about him being exposed to the Fulham attack, but first I want to hear your initial hot take, because he had a bit of a wobbly start. I feel like people have forgotten that because of the goal.
In a way, though, I feel better about him as a result of that, because it would have been very easy had that happened. For him to kind of disappear into himself a little bit, because that's a pretty, it's different because there were no fans. It wasn't a particularly hostile atmosphere at Craven Cottage, of course. But that's quite an unsettling moment for a young player. You come into a new league, a new team in a new country, and one of the first things you do is you nearly give the opposition a goal and get your own goalkeeper sent off.
Yeah.
So actually, in a way, you could spin that and say, what a recovery, because he had a very solid game. I concede that Fulham were no sort of presence at the other end of the pitch. So he will face other challenges throughout the season. But it was assured, wasn't it? I mean, nice goal, always good. But a good recovery, good mental strength. Bit tenuous, but yeah, really encouraging.
Alex, what about you?
Yes, I mean, he was encouraging for sure. I think the benefits of having a left-sided centre-back with a left foot were obvious. Tom Warville did a really, really good piece on that just before the weekend, explaining why left-sided centre-backs are so important in terms of opening up passing lanes from that side of the pitch.
Why is it? Can you walk me through it? Because I didn't read that piece yet. I will read it, but I haven't done.
Yeah, well, there's two things to say. Because Arsenal have Tierney as a left-sided centre-back as well, but one who pushes forwards really quite high. What it means is that when you're kicking with your left foot towards the left side, you can get the ball to curl away from the centre of the pitch and then come back around. Whereas if you're a right-footed centre-back in that outer left position, your natural kicking angle takes the ball infield first, which makes it easier to press and easier to cut off that passing lane. So it's basically, it offers more security in transition, because when you kick the ball, it's not going as close to the opposition, basically. The opposition have to spread wider to try and cut off that passing lane. And Gabriel had a huge amount of the ball go through him. He completed 109 passes, which was more than any other Arsenal player. He attempted considerably more than any other Arsenal player as well. I think defensively, which, you know, was sort of the question that you posed at the beginning, you know, what did we learn about him against Fulham? Nothing as a defender, really. Because Fulham were really quite bad in the final third. I think that, you know, Fulham were an incredibly high possession team, high pass volume team. Last season, I think they were second, if you put all Premier League and Championship sides together, they were second for pass volume and possession. So we knew that their build-up would be good, but it was slightly baffling, I think, to leave Mitrovic on the bench for so long. Kamara didn't really offer a great deal up front, and I don't think defensively Arsenal were tested at all, to be fair.
Can I ask you, Seb, about Michael Hector? I don't want to leave Fulham untouched in this part of the conversation. When I saw him, I don't know if this is a kind of an unconscious bias on my part to judge people who are taller and stronger looking as better defenders when they enter the pitch. But when I saw him, I thought, oh, he's going to be a good defender. And I thought, yeah, generally speaking, had quite a good game. He looked frustrated at times. And he's, of course, only just arrived at Fulham. But he looks like a capable player. What do you think about him?
Yeah, I've never been quite sure about Michael Hector. I mean, I can't detach him in my mind from the moment when Chelsea signed him and there was a little bit of a backlash from the fans. It wasn't really about Michael Hector at the time. It was just because Chelsea had grown used to signing a particular type of player. And that was during the period where, you know, their transfer policy became a little bit underwhelming and it caused a little bit of consternation among their fan base. Yeah. I like him as a footballer. I think you're showing your age a little bit, which is great for me to be able to say that to you rather than the other way around, in kind of what we assume to be like a good centre-half. Because I think exactly the same. When I see someone of that build, especially in the Premier League, I find it really reassuring. Like, you see someone that can physically look after himself. I think he's a pretty good footballer. I think the side of it, the actual technical side of Michael Hector's game gets a little bit overlooked from time to time.
Yes.
I wonder whether, when we talk about Fulham's defence and their individual defenders, I'm instructed by what I saw last time round, when they had some pretty good defenders in their pack. Like, I remember them signing Alfie Mawson last time they got promoted, and the whole system was so poor that everyone kind of suffered individually as a result. So I'm a little bit worried for him in that regard, but I do like him as a player.
There's an interesting point here very quickly to make, though, which I think I first encountered in Soconomics, which is that when you're scouting players, there are certain things that have very little to do with football that make a player stand out. So, for example, scouts are more likely to write a good report or have their eye caught by blonde players rather than dark-haired players because they stand out more. By the same token, I think free kicks are often overrated because the game stops for a free kick, so everyone can kind of concentrate, and it makes it easier to remember that instance rather than what happens during the ebb and flow of a game. And I think potentially, you know, very tall footballers with hairstyles that stand out are players that you notice more, even if they aren't actually doing as much. They catch the eye simply because physically they stand out compared to the players around them.
Another possibility to add to your list, I texted Seb during the Everton-Tottenham game, and I said, Everton are a much more attractive team than Tottenham. I mean, literally in the physical appearance of the players. And, you know, Matt, perhaps it was just because Pierre Højbjerg wasn't having a very good game and looked a little sweaty. But, you know, I felt like all of the new players that Everton have brought in looked were very physically attractive. I wonder if that plays a part too.
They are quite a handsome team.
We should certainly explore that.
You know, though, when you texted me, we spoke about this at the time, but Pierre-Emile Højbjerg looks like Ethan Hawke during his training day years.
He does. Months.
It's quite unsettling.
Which suggests a positive moral attitude, but you know, and a future career of fantastic indie film choices.
Oh, well, he certainly stands up for himself. And, like, Denzel's quite a bad influence in that film, obviously. Ethan Hawke is on the right side of that argument, I'd say.
Who's the Denzel Washington of the Everton team?
Interesting. Like, I feel that's the kind of thing that if I answered it, we could probably get sued somehow for a kind of tenuous reason I don't properly understand.
We'll circle back around to that in a few
years. Yeah, well, let's go back to the football. Let's go back to our comfort zone, I think.
Well, I want to... comfort zone. Let's talk about Willian, because Willian, of course, it was fairly big news that he refused the deal that was on the table at Chelsea, which seems fairly so. They seem to have a number of players who can play in those forward wide positions now. He moved to Arsenal, started the game, played very well. He was a significant part of that first goal, the sort of goal-mouth scramble goal, which Lacazette eventually touched in. And I think that, personally, from my perspective, watching that game, it seemed that that goal really gave Arsenal the confidence that they didn't have prior to that. They weren't playing particularly well. I thought they were quite nothingy before the first goal. And then the team changed completely. Alex, what did you make of Willian's performance? Because it's been a long time since Arsenal have had a player of that profile in that position, i.e. a right-footed player at right wing.
Yeah, he didn't play right wing, though, particularly. I mean, he drifted in a lot. I think what's quite interesting is that his style of playing right wing at Chelsea, and I think we talked about this in a previous pod, was very much about what he did without the ball. It was very much about the pressing side of it. And then when he did attack, he would quite often stay really quite wide and use that right foot to deliver crosses in. Here we saw him moving very much more into the centre of the pitch, kind of almost playing as a 10 at times. And I think there's a real benefit for Arsenal there, because Willian is an astute presser. He's very dynamic with the ball, and he was able to link play. His movement was intelligent, and I think that Arsenal front unit, once they got going, and it did take a little bit of time, I agree, but once they got going, they looked a lot more fluid. Bellerin was creating an awful lot going wide right, but also cutting inside, and when Bellerin cut inside, Willian would move out and vice versa. So there was some really nice kind of interchange and swapping on that side there. And I think, you know, it bodes really well for Arsenal that there was after that sort of first 5-10 minutes, there was a real fluidity in how all of the front players worked together, and, you know, Lacazette dropping off. But they're I think the thing that struck me most was that there wasn't really a moment where you felt like there were too many Arsenal players in the same part of the pitch. There was enough movement and enough interchange that they didn't crowd each other out, that the runs were making space for other players to move into, that, you know, if one was overlapping, one was cutting inside. It looked good. Again, with the caveat that it was against Fulham, who are a newly promoted side, and bedding in a new centre-back and all the rest of it. But I think the signs were very promising.
So, yeah, I mean, Willian has won the Premier League twice with Chelsea. Presumably that is a sort of invaluable experience that is useful to add to your squad.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think how valuable that commodity depends on the kind of squad that the player's coming into. I think there are winners in that team. There are players who you know, have dealt with the kind of the pressures that exist at World Cups. I think an interesting dynamic is that Willian and David Luiz get on very well. There's actually a story out this morning about how Oscar, the former Chelsea attacking midfielder, when Willian joined, apparently David Luiz and Willian tried to convince him to come back to England as well. I really like it. I find it very reassuring when those little networks exist within a team, within a squad. But Willian is also a really good player. I feel like he's a little bit of a victim of the length of his contract, because obviously he came into the club and the talk was not of what a good player he still is, because he very much is, but the length of the deal, the size of it, and how that related to the redundancies that Arsenal had just announced. And that's a very pertinent conversation, but it's absolutely not his fault that he's arrived into that scenario. If it had been a 2-year deal, you know, or even just a 1-year deal, I don't think anyone would disagree with this being just a really smart little addition. And as a footballer, like, I feel like Arsenal haven't had a player of that profile for quite a long time. You know, they haven't had someone. Alex talked about how he drifted in against Fulham. Like, Arsenal haven't really had a player that seems comfortable moving from out to in, if that makes sense, on that side of the pitch. They've had Theo Walcott there. Alex Iwobi would play there a little bit as well. I really like the sort of the style of footballer that he is. He's just a really good utility attacking player that can do lots of things on the ball and lots of things without it. It's just a really encouraging start.
Okay, well, very exciting. I'm pleased for Willian, who seems like a nice chap, doesn't he? Let's talk about the goalkeeping situation, though. Seb, I'm going to throw it straight back to you. Explain to me what this issue is here, because I've kind of missed this in the summer.
Yeah, it's a bit confusing. So obviously, when the restart happened, Bernd Leno got injured against Brighton with that incident with Neil Maupay, and in came Emiliano Martinez to take his end. He played very well. I mean, a lot of people made the mistake of thinking that he was a kind of a young, up-and-coming goalkeeper. He's actually in his late 20s, and he's waited an awfully long time to have the opportunity as a number one. And he did brilliantly. He was excellent in that sort of that mini FA Cup run. He had a couple of moments which weren't bad, but were sort of less than spectacular. Didn't have a particularly good game against Tottenham at White Hart Lane or Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. But he's a kind of goalkeeper. He's a contrast to Leno, who I've always feel like Leno is more likely to make a spectacular save. He is probably technically the better goalkeeper, but the Martinez's fundamentals are really interesting. Like he catches the ball a lot. The ball doesn't bounce off him. So when he makes saves, there was one against Manchester City which he made off, I think, Bernardo Silva. Could be wrong about that. A really good plunging save to his left hand side, and the ball stuck to his glove. Doesn't come off him, doesn't give up rebounds. And that was a big part of Arsenal winning the FA Cup. And he's obviously moved to Villa for a lot of money. And I just wonder, it might be a decision instructed by the economic situation and the pressures exerted by the pandemic. But it just seemed as if, for the first time in a really long while, Arsenal had two goalkeepers that could really compete for the same position at a high level, and not in a kind of Almunia Fabianski sense, where it's just kind of like, I appreciate that Fabianski's gone on to become a very fine goalkeeper, but back then he really wasn't. And I don't know, it's just a shame. I think that having finally had the chance to make a name for himself at Arsenal, as soon as his window opened, it shut again. And he's kind of wanted the opportunity to move. I just feel like maybe you know, from a fundamentals perspective, Martinez wasn't obviously inferior. So it seems a little rash to me, that's all.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I wonder if that's just the perfect scenario for Arsenal, that they get a spell to test their second keeper, who they know maybe that wants to leave and maybe they can make some money on. He performs really well over the course of a couple of months, and then they probably sell him for a lot more money than they would have done if happened, right?
You're not getting £20 million for him if he gets sold in April. With that question, I think that's a very, very good point, Joe.
Okay, well, best of luck to him. This podcast is brought to you by Hims. Now, if you haven't heard of Hims, they're basically your best mate when it comes to those tricky men's health problems. Balding is an awkward topic for men, yet a lot of us start to lose our hair before we hit 40. And the best way to take control of hair loss is to do something about it while you still have some hair. Don't wait until it's all gone before you do something about it, because it's more difficult then. Hims was created to make it easier for guys to seek care, especially guys who avoid seeing their doctor in person for awkward health conversations. Hello, because not everyone wants to have personal conversations face-to-face with a stranger in a white coat. Personally, I don't at all. I'm worried they're going to take me away. So Hims connects you to real doctors online, which could save you hours. It's completely confidential and discreet. You get a proper consultation, and they'll give you sound advice on just what you can do to help your hair before it's too late. And it couldn't be easier to book your free consultation. Just go to forhims.com/athletic. That's forhims.co.uk/athletic. Okay, let's discuss Liverpool-Leeds. It was the evening game on the opening day of the season. 4-3, exceptionally exciting. I don't know about both of you. I felt, bad for Leeds come the end of that difficult penalty to give away, a striker's penalty, as the pundits kept saying. But Leeds were exceptionally exciting, and bar the fact that I couldn't recognise any of the players because half the team has a top knot, and that's not a criticism of top knot, by the way, it's just ordinarily it is a identifiable feature in a footballer. You know, oh, that's the one with the top knot, that means he's this person, and when I'm learning about a team that I haven't spent much time watching, I'll focus on the top knot. I spent the first half of the first half thinking, like, that guy with the top knot is so good.
He's everywhere.
He is, like, all over the pitch. We have a free roll. I didn't realise this was part of Bielsa's approach. Speaking of, let's talk about Bielsa's approach. I want to hear about his setup. I want to see to what extent that he did achieve it. I believe Alex was unavailable to watch this game, so we've subbed in Seb as our tactical appreciator for this segment. And I, for one, cannot wait to hear him do his best Alex Stewart impression.
What was really interesting is that for most of this game, it looked as if neither team was playing with a midfield. And there were times where, like Leeds, I think a lot of people who watched Leeds in the Championship thought that there'd be some modification to their press once they arrived in the Champions in the Premier League, because you look at sort of you look at the way that players play the ball out from the back in the Premier League. And in this instance, you're looking at someone like Virgil van Dijk, who's, you know, as a passer as there is at this level. And you thought, okay, Leeds are going to be a little bit more conservative. And I think I counted three or four times in the first half where Leeds were pressing high with about five players. and it was wonderful. It was, I mean...
Yeah, no, totally.
Full disclosure, I haven't really enjoyed football without the crowds, even on television. I just don't... It's something missing for me, and I don't engage in the same way. And this was one of the first games I've enjoyed since the restart, where it actually...
I think many people feel like that.
I hope so, because... And I think part of it was Leeds' approach, because it was high-octane, it was full-blooded, and there was a real spectacle to the way they worked without the ball, which I didn't expect to see. I knew when I tune in to watch Leeds in the Championship, I knew what to see, what I was going to see. In the Premier League, sometimes, and this isn't necessarily about Bielsa or Leeds, it's just about promoted size in general, you sometimes see a little bit of a conservatism creep in. They get caught between what they've been doing well and what they think they should then be doing to survive. And I suppose, rationally, Bielsa is the last person to make a kind of concession like that, isn't he? but it was structural chaos, and it was absolutely wonderful as a result. And also, hey, listen, let's not go overboard with praising the press, because actually a lot of what Leeds did with the ball was excellent. Like Jack Harrison's goal was really good. Yeah. The third goal, Glick's goal, like the first touch and the control volley of a spinning ball, that's as good. I know it's not going to make the kind of the end of season highlights, but that is as good a technical goal as you're going to see all season. Really great. And it was the first game I've seen for a really long time, which I've actually enjoyed and invested in. And I haven't ended up muting and watching something else on like Netflix or something at the same time. I probably shouldn't admit to that, but I find it really hard to engage properly with football without the crowd. And this was the exception to that rule. It was just great to see.
I agree with what you said, Seb. I loved how high Leeds pressed. I thought it was just hilariously exciting. I couldn't believe that there wasn't a midfield. I did wonder what it would make Liverpool fans feel about the possibility of incoming transfers. But, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about Thiago, hasn't there? And I did wonder, fans watching that game, what they might feel about their midfield afterwards. Should we be worried about Liverpool in this regard? Because, I mean, I don't, you know, don't want to use this as an opportunity to take away from Leeds' performance, who I think were fantastic. But that isn't the Liverpool that we have come to know. Were they simply frazzled by Leeds? Or is it, you know, perhaps something about tiredness? They just didn't seem quite as sharp, with the exception, of course, of Mohamed Salah, Seb.
So when I watched the game on Saturday night, I thought, yeah, this is a little bit strange, because there's... I think I sort of bought into all the ideas about, you know, what happens to a team when, you know, they complete their cycle, when they win everything there is to win. As the weekend went on, though, and I saw a few of the other teams, I think appreciated just what an issue fitness is going to be this year, because you see the chaos in some of the other sides and you see how loose some of the mechanics were around the division. I think it was just a fitness thing. I think
we're going to talk about Tottenham, by the way, but carry on.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, they were the worst example of the lot. But I think in Liverpool, I think one of the issues was like Jordan Henderson was clearly not fit. And over time, we're hearing more and more of the stories from pre-season coming out about, you know, quarantining and some players not getting the right amount of time with the rest of the group. And so I think we have to, at least in these first few weeks, I think we're going to have to excuse some of these imperfections and certainly not read too much into them. I think Liverpool could do with a little bit of a refresh and a little bit more competition in certain areas. But I don't necessarily think this was a manifestation of that issue. I think it was just one of those things. And also, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to use words like underestimated, but I think maybe, I think it was quite reasonable for Jurgen Klopp and Jurgen Klopp's players to think that Leeds would be a little bit more conservative, but they weren't. And they got rattled. Like, it was, there were some uncharacteristic moments, certainly the Bamford goal. Like, how often do you see Virgil van Dijk do that? I mean, you can count on one hand over the last 3 years. So it might just be an oddity. I think we need to see a couple more games before we start.
Oh, sorry. No, I was talking to
you.
You go.
Absolutely.
I was going to say that you could see that Virgil van Dijk was having a bad game just based on how hard he was trying to have a good game in attack.
You know, he
was clearly frustrated. And when his goal was disallowed, quite fairly, I think. I mean, I understand why he was angry, because he played no part in the block off, en route to the goal. But he was, you know, he's clearly furious on the basis that he hadn't had a stellar performance to that part. You mentioned Patrick Bamford. I did want to talk about him just very briefly, and I know it's a bit of a tried and tested topic. But there's been so much conversation about whether or not he could make it in the Premier League. To me, certainly on the evidence of this game, he looked like he was essentially at home. I think he's obviously supported by the fact that Leeds just have a lot of big, strong players around him who are all extremely fast as well. And therefore, he's going to be able to find space. But he did exactly what he's there to do in terms of drawing people, in terms of making those runs, and also getting a goal when a mistake presents an opportunity. I thought I didn't think he was fantastic, but I thought he was basically good. And that's presumably, you know, the first port of call to answering that question that so many people had.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, we texted about this at the time, because when he scored his goal, I think we both said it's good for him, because had he not, then maybe we're going into 2 or 3 weeks when he doesn't score.
Yeah.
And he's got a £30 million forward sitting on the bench behind him. And I think actually Patrick Bamford mentioned this on his Twitter. Within 24 hours of Leeds winning promotion, people were going, he's not going to score goals at the level above. You know, hasn't got a good record in the Premier League, despite, you know, he's played fewer than maybe 20 games at that level. And so I think it was a good way to kind of silence the conversation. I don't know whether really goals are the currency for a forward in that formation. I mean, they're important because he's a centre forward and you'll always be judged by them. But I think the value in Bamford is his work rate. And I do accept that that's a little bit of a euphemism for forwards who don't score goals. It's kind of the Roberto Soldado excuse at Tottenham. You know, well, let's use him as a number 10. He works very hard, you know, that kind of stuff. But in this case, I think this was the perfect example of that. Bamford makes the effort to be in the position to capitalise on the mistake, to not allow Virgil van Dijk to be so flippant with his clearance, so carefree with his defending. And he takes advantage of that. Is he someone that's going to score, you know, is he going to take every chance he gets? I don't think so. Is he going to be more of a kind of a 1 in 5 opportunities guy? Probably. But that doesn't make him any less valuable at this moment, because there, as we've already seen, there are other players in that Leeds formation that can score goals, and they are not reliant on one method of attack to score their goals. They're not mining goals from the same area over and over again, like a couple of other newly promoted sides have done over the last few years.
It's going to be instructive to see City and United play next weekend, I think, so that we can try and have some kind of basis for fitness levels, but also what expected level of performance we should have. Because Chelsea, you know, we mentioned them already. They weren't fantastic. Oh no, we haven't mentioned them already, have we? We were going to chat a little bit about Chelsea. We might do that if we have time at the end. If not, I'll just say now that they didn't strike any fear into Brighton. Quite the opposite. Brighton, I thought Brighton were fantastic in that game. They really took the game to Chelsea. We mentioned this beforehand, but Kai Havertz just seemed kind of invisible. Like, he didn't really seem to make any impact on the game at all. He was subbed off at 80 minutes, and I didn't notice he was gone until 87 when I texted you. So I think, you know, I think it'll be instructive for us to see the performances of Manchester City and Manchester United, next weekend or the coming weekend to see if we can make any kind of early comparisons on the basis of how strong teams are supposed to be playing, with the idea in mind that that fitness problem is going to be ever present, I would have thought, for most clubs. But next, let us discuss Tottenham Everton. Okay, I want to start with Everton's new look midfield here, because the effect of Abdoulaye Doucouré and Alan, and also of course pre-existing player Andre Gomes in that midfield, it was so exciting. I mean, I'd seen that these transfers were taking place with Everton, and obviously the big pull had been James Rodriguez over the last few weeks, and so that had been the one that most people have been focusing on. Alan had sort of registered in my subconscious and not really transferred to my conscious that much. And also, I think Abdoulaye Doucouré, I have been very impressed by him in last season at Watford, but I didn't, I just didn't really make that jump until I saw them all together. And then suddenly, I got very, very excited, Seb. You can see why, can't you? They just provided an incredible platform for Everton's attacking players to move forward from. They just seem to be in control of the game at all times. Their tight passing, not only was it exceptionally crisp, but the pace with which their passing happened, and was, it felt like wonderful one-touch control and then pass on football. Tottenham didn't look like they wanted to run anyway, but even if they did, you felt that they would have had a difficult time dealing with the way that Everton's midfield controlled that game. And that is in their first game playing together with a bunch of new players there. For me, that is a very positive sign for the season. I don't know if I'm getting too carried away, but Alex, do you want to take me through the James Rodriguez part of this, how he fits in and what his influence on the attacking players?
Yeah, I think it was a fantastic performance by Everton. What I really, really liked about it was, so Alan had this stellar season at Napoli under Sarri, and played on the right-hand side of a midfield three, pushed forward a lot, did a lot of the defensive work as well, but a genuine kind of box-to-box midfielder. Here, he was much, much deeper, playing Doucouré played what I thought Alan's role would be. And there was a fluidity there, the way that Doucouré was getting ahead of the rest of the midfield, the way that Gomez was dropping away from the 10 spot into the kind of deep left half space and playing balls forwards, Alan keeping everything solid, James Rodriguez drifting in and out. Like this was a midfield who at no point during certainly the first sort of 60 or 70 minutes that I watched at any point looked like they didn't know exactly what they were supposed to be doing. So again, as we said with Arsenal too, there was a fluidity about the interchange there. When Gomez dropped off, Doucouré would push up. When Gomez stayed high, Doucouré would drift slightly wider and James would drift inside. Like this was a very, very well-oiled, very kind of functional midfield with everybody doing specific bits and pieces. Alan kept it very, very solid at the back. And I think, yes, he was helped in that by the lack of a sustained and thoughtful pressing by Spurs, which I'm sure Seb will want to talk about later as a Spurs fan. But, everything here seemed with Everton to be about, like you say, Joe, progressing the ball crisply forwards, but doing it in such a way as to make sure that there was a receiving player between the lines. And I think that was what was so clever, was that every time the ball was moved forwards, it was moved forwards to a player that was in a position to receive it in between the lines, who almost clearly knew what the next pass was going to be as well. I think you saw good switches of play from left to right by Gomez and from right to left by James Rodriguez. Dina was able to find an awful lot of space on the left-hand side. If there was any criticism, I think it was a criticism that was also highlighted in the commentary that I watched, which was that Calvert-Lewin occasionally looked a little bit isolated, and maybe Richarlison will play slightly tighter in towards him. But, this was a side that was arranged as a 4-2-3-1, but there was so much movement and so much interchange that it was very difficult really to kind of say what the actual formation was. At times it looked like a 4-4-2, at times it looked like a 4-3-3.
A lot of places had it down as a 4-3-3 as well, which confused me because that is not what I thought at the beginning of the game.
It's not, and you can, I mean, one of the ways that you can sometimes detect that is to look at the position that the players are in when they're pressing or in their mid block, which actually to me almost looked more like a 4-1-4-1. But then again, there would be mobility from the central pressers. Sometimes that would be Gomez almost pushing up into a 4-4-2, with Richarlison staying wide, Tamas staying wide. At other times, it would be Doucouré that would push up, and you know it. But you could see again that the defensive system, it wasn't a really active or aggressive press, but they knew what they were doing. They knew where they were supposed to be. And I think what we can infer from this is that, you know, Ancelotti, whether it's because he's had enough time or because he's a good enough coach or because he has a relationship with some of these players already, he's got a plan. And I think from, you know, I didn't watch an awful lot of the football over the weekend, but to me, the two teams that you could look at and say from a tactical perspective, they really clearly had a plan, were Everton and Arsenal. And I don't think you could necessarily say that as much for the other teams. Very, very promising start.
Just two things to pick up on there. I would say, I think this was pointed out by the commentary team too, but at times last season, Everton had the most success when they played Richarlison a lot closer to Calvert-Lewin. So there's a point to be made there. And I wonder how it's a bit of a jigsaw trying to fit all of those players, including James Rodriguez, into that. So it'd be interesting to see if they do play around with the system at all, or if it's different indeed when they play a team that would consider to be below them in the league positions. The other thing is, you mentioned Ancelotti's relationship with some of those players or prior relationship. What I loved about this game, I think it was my favourite moment, was when James Rodriguez is being substituted off and he's walking to the sidelines and he's walking over to Ancelotti. He looks up at him and he makes this kind of very subtle eyebrow quirk, which is suggestive of a kind of a friendly, mutually respected relationship. Obviously, they have a prior relationship too. And it just seemed so subtle. It seemed very cool, I thought. It seemed like... it's the sort of reaction I would have had after playing a game of football like that. Just no big deal, pretty cool, that's going quite well. It suggested a maturity. I mean, I haven't spent a huge amount of time watching James Rodriguez off the pitch, so I really don't know anything about him. But I felt like it was a sort of a bit of body language that was very revealing, potentially, about the character. Seb, I'm going to let you talk about Spurs, because they were just fucking awful.
You know what? They were so bad that I spent part of the second half paying my council tax and I had a good time. Wow. Like, it was satisfying. Like, it was, I felt like I'd achieved something. It was so dispiriting, and for a few reasons. I think the let's put the caveat out there to start with, because we've talked about conditioning and the problems posed to Liverpool by the schedule. Tottenham have suffered similarly. Harry Kane, I think, only trained once with the group. After returning from England duty, there have been other disruptions. Very clearly, Jose Mourinho wants to do some further transfer business, which he hasn't had the opportunity to do yet. Nevertheless, with all those excuses out of the way, it was embarrassing. It was actually humiliating. Not because Tottenham lost, because that's actually, as you guys have just covered, that's actually shaping up to be a really good Everton side, hopefully. I think the attitude was not just suspect, but really concerning. Obviously, whilst we've been waiting for the season to start, a lot of us have been watching the All or Nothing series. And there's quite a few instances during it where in the various episodes, a player talks about how much respect they have for Jose Mourinho, what a privilege it is to play for him, you know, how much they could learn. Now, what I'd say to people is look at the player's eyes when they're talking. They just look, it looks so lifeless and just automated and weird. And it was just...
It's the PR line, isn't it? The best coach in the world.
Well, it is. And also, you know, a lot of Tottenham's kind of, you know, subliminal messaging since Mourinho started, came into the club, has been, look, we'll do what we can with this year, but next season, fresh start, new beginning, you know, clean slate for everybody. That's when we start to judge people. And it was the worst Tottenham opening day performance I've seen since probably they lost to Sunderland to a very, very late, I think, Michael Chopra goal years and years ago, or the Ivan Campo game at Bolton. It was just so hopeless. There was no. The main criticism of Mourinho would probably be that, yes, there was no pressing, but also there was no effect from any of his changes, any of his substitutions. I mean, he shifted the shape of his defence. He went to a back three when he removed Matt Doherty. He brought on a more dynamic midfielder, Moussa Sissoko. He replaced Dele Alli. He brought on Tanguy Ndombele to try and change the passing dynamic in his midfield. Nothing made a difference at all. The tone of the performance was identical all the way through the game. And it actually deteriorated once Calvert-Lewin scored. There was no... It was like watching a group of players sulk.
There was no comeback. You spent the rest of the game, like, the only genuine memories I have of the rest of that game from Tottenham's perspective was Harry Kane just repeatedly pushing people, the game stopped. Like, I swear that happened at three or four different incidences. And all I could think was, like, the repeated, like, mention of that scene in All or Nothing where Mourinho is telling them to like, be bastards on the pitch. You know, I feel like this is all that's left of Harry Kane now. is just a man gently pushing people around when let's be honest, no one had done anything wrong, just, you know, completely unnecessary. I remember about Tottenham, apart from just nothing.
You know, the scene that made me think of is when right at the beginning he talks to Kane about, you know, what he's going to do for his profile in the game, trying to make him a superstar, you know, Ronaldo, yeah. Messi, Kane. It's a little bit of an unrealistic objective anyway, but you watch Kane and he just looks so miserable. Because there's nothing for him to feed off. Tottenham don't really create chances. They sit, they protect, they break. And there's no structure to the attacking play. It's just, it seems as simple as, let's try and get as many players forward and see if we can capitalise on those mismatches. And it was hopeless. Honestly, it was hopeless.
It's very weird as well, because when I watch a team, or when I watch a game where I know I'm concentrating on a particular side, I do tend not to notice an awful lot what the other team are doing, because I kind of get fixated on what I'm looking at. But it was very, very difficult to... This is going to sound like a weird thing to say. It was really difficult to notice Tottenham. It was like there was a group of people in blue that were doing all kinds of clever and intricate stuff. And then occasionally you'd see a white shirt moving towards somebody in a slightly lackluster fashion, and then they'd disappear off again. Like that, there was an absence to Tottenham's play, which is something I very rarely observe in a game. And, you know, there were one or two moments, like the Doherty's chance and the Alli chance as well. But by and large, you know, Tottenham were conspicuous by their absence rather than anything else. And I do think, yes, like we said, Everton played really well, and a lot of sides would have struggled to do that. But there was nothing about Spurs where you could look at it and say that there's a consistent plan here. You know, that there's a pattern to what's happening that makes it noticeable and makes it stand out to the eye. It just wasn't there.
I don't think that's a weird thing to say at all. I think it's very, very fair, because the issue we've highlighted is passivity, and also, you know, I think it ties in quite nicely to the point that Joe makes about Everton's midfield, and Alex's point, your point about the way Rodriguez worked. It's like you have this group of players that haven't played together at all, and it functions really nicely. And the implication being that on the other side of the ball, Tottenham were absolutely chaotic. Højbjerg was dreadful. Like, his first game, so we make excuses, and, you know, it's not fair to judge someone off that. But honestly, it was one of the worst Tottenham debuts I've ever seen, and that's a long list. If you go back long enough, there's some very bad players on that list.
I worry with Højbjerg. I worry with midfielders who leave Southampton and end up not doing as well, because I, particularly under Hasenhüttl, but also under Pochettino, there was such a structure and a system to the way that Southampton press, that I think it's going to take quite a lot of time for Højbjerg to adapt to moving away from being so system oriented into a different system. You know, he was rushing around. He was trying to do stuff. It was the fact that, and I agree, he was dreadful, but I wonder how much of that is because if he had been rushing around in that fashion in a Southampton side, he would have had James Ward-Prowse knowing where to fill in, and he would have had Nathan Redmond tucking inside, and the press would have been orchestrated. And there's a Tom Warville piece that I think was published today in The Athletic about the difference between pressing and pressure, and the idea of, you know, applying a single run towards the ball to try and force something to happen, whereas pressing is like a sustained and orchestrated attempt to win back the ball with a series of movements that occur simultaneously. We did a video on Bielsa and Klopp and how they press, which explains some of these concepts. But, you know, Højbjerg was applying pressure to the ball, or pressure to the man, but there was no press around that because nobody else was doing it.
This is it. If there's one thing which is worse than no press, it's one player pressing by himself.
Absolutely right. Yeah,
let's give him a little bit of an out. I think what I saw from Højbjerg was a lot of what Alex has described, but also a player who's very aware that he was making his debut, has been signed for quite a lot of money, that is, you know, at a new level in his career. You know, if we discount the sort of the
he knows he looks like Ethan Hawke.
He knows he looks like Ethan Hawke, and he's trying to fight back against that. but it was so dispiriting, and it was just kind of right. Well, you know, Tottenham Mourinho is just, it reminds me of like one of those really, really unhappy marriages from my like grandparents' generation where they're just, you know, they can't beat each other and they're just waiting for it to end somehow.
I think that's
death,
why
death like is that. The only escape.
Exactly.
I think that's why Kane boiled over as well, because Kane was doing individual pressures a lot too. But unsuccessfully, because nobody was backing him up. So if he was moving towards Pickford, for example, there was always an easy out ball, whether it was to the right-hand side or even to the centre where Gomez was dropping in. And if you're Kane and you've got fitness problems anyway, and you know your job is to be at the front to score opportunities, none of which came, and you're putting in the effort to try and close the ball down all the time and no one's helping you, like, I'd lose my temper as well.
It's just a way to... You know what, though? It's the thing you do, like, that if Mourinho hasn't asked for it, if the coach hasn't asked for the players to do that, and actually, the most recent episode of the documentary that I watched, he talked about the forward line pressing and no one else pressing, right? Yeah. So, I mean, that was a very specific system, perhaps, to that game. But if Mourinho hasn't asked for anyone to do that, and Kane realises the game is going badly, is trying to chase it, it is, not to be critical, but it is the thing that players do when they are aware that the world is watching them, and they want to make it look like they're trying really hard, and they want to try hard, is they pressure the ball even if no one else is, and then they complain when other people aren't doing it. Like, it's very difficult for us to say because we don't know what the coach has actually asked them to do. We can assume that whatever that is, it was probably wrong on the basis of the result and the performance, but it, as Seb said as well, Mourinho tried to affect the game several times. Like, he did try to make progressive changes, and he got nothing from his players. So in a way, I feel a bit like defending him, even if his toxicity is the reason that this has happened. We are going to have to wrap up, I think, because we all have a meeting to go to. But before we do, I want to talk about this another time. So let's just pen this in the diary. But the impact of those players watching themselves in that documentary, I don't think is insignificant at all. And I think its release just before the season has started, in the off-season, a time where the players have the ability to watch it, discuss it, and make observations that they ordinarily wouldn't be able to make, I think is very, very significant. So I want to come back and talk about that another time. But for now, we must go. Thank you so much for listening. Remember, you can download The Athletic by visiting theathletic.com/TIFO for £1 a month as part of an introductory offer at the moment, which is really fantastic. Incredible value, a wonderful deal. Please take us up on that. Seb, thank you.
Thank you very much, Joe.
Alex, thank you.
Thanks, Joe.
Producer Adonis, thank you.
This is the difference between a team of and a team of good guys.
There he goes. And we'll be back next week with something else that's the same but different. Bye, 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 bye.